Welcome back, Gavin Riley with you on the record until 1 o'clock. Now, as we've already been talking with Neil, it is obviously a tremendous weekend for the Springboks, a team which in many ways embodies the power of sport to unify people across tribes and races and ethnicities and what have you. Of course, in very different times and in a very different Ireland, the 1970s visit of a Springboks team to Ireland caused real political controversy, and it did lead to a game being played behind a barbed wire fence at Lansdowne Road. So with the weekend that's in it and with the historical anniversaries at home, it seems like a fitting time to talk about the visit of South Africa to Ireland in 1970, and Donald Fallon has popped in to help us do just that. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to be here.
Sport, of course, has done an awful lot to heal some of the wounds in South Africa.
It has, and the immortal words of Madiba or Nelson Mandela, you know, sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite like little else does. It speaks to youth in a language they understand. Sport can create hope where once there was only despair. That is very, very true. And what a remarkable performance it was from South Africa to take the Rugby World Cup. And what a weekend of coverage, really, not only on how brilliant the team were in their home nation, you know, captained by a black athlete, their multilingual anthem, the cross-section of society that gets behind them. But also it ties in nicely with things at home.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Actually, I'm just struck in passing that with all of the talk about the multilingual anthem or the way in which cultural emblems of previous eras have been sort of nicely co-opted in its modern day South Africa, it could be lessons to follow here if we ever have reunity and we need to figure out how to reconcile different traditions here. You mentioned obviously this is the same weekend that the Irish media have been remembering a very different time in
South
Africa.
Absolutely, yeah. Regime. I mean, this weekend the focus was very much in Dublin on 35 years ago, the anniversary of the Dunn Stores strike, which was that moment of tremendous kind of opposition to apartheid South Africa that achieved international recognition, and a strike that went on for, you know, an incredible 3 years.
That it went on that long.
Absolutely.
You kind of just think of it as being a quick fix and that
Mary Manning, a young cashier on the desk in Dunn Stores, you know, kicked off this 3 year industrial unrest. So let's combine these things, you know, sport and history. And it seems fitting to look at the visit of the Springboks to Ireland in 1970. Now, it's a visit that's remembered today for very significant scenes of protest, but it also caused a lot of political debate. And digging into the archives of the Oireachtas for this piece, I found a great quote from Fine Gael TD Patrick Donegan, who made his views very clear on the arrival of the Springboks. He said, "We've heard a great deal about the Springboks tour. We all deplore the fact that there's discrimination in South Africa, but I have come to the conclusion that 15 men on one side and 15 men on the other, all young, rolling around in the mud, have nothing on their minds but where they're going to get the prettiest girl and take her out for a meal as soon as the match is over. And I'm afraid that is not political. And if I'm not at the Springboks match, I shall be out hunting. And anyone who wants to protest about either can protest away."
15 young men rolling around in the mud. That's
Donegan was unique enough in the Dáil when it came to this issue. I mean, most of the House agreed that this visit was not a good thing.
Yeah. In Britain, at least, though, the roots of the controversy went back to other sporting scandals, and it didn't all start with rugby.
Yeah, they arrived in Ireland, the Springboks, having completed a kind of 2 month tour of Britain, which had witnessed very considerable scenes of protest and opposition. And really, what had happened is the opposition to the Springboks had gone beyond the kind of traditional anti-apartheid campaigners, and it spread into something in many sporting bodies, because there was this recent very bitter memory in British sporting circles. Just a few years before the Springboks arrived in Britain and Ireland to play rugby, 1967, there was shock in British sporting circles. The apartheid government basically announced that they wouldn't allow a black South African cricketer who played for England to take part in England's cricket tour.
So it all started with cricket rather than rugby.
Yeah, and cricket does not tend to be a source of, you know, kind of political agitation and disagreement. But the potential inclusion of a non-white cricketer in a team caused like a massive diplomatic incident in South Africa. And some senior kind of South African figure suggested that this was a move designed to cause political embarrassment, you know, that Britain were trying to bring this black South African
to play. They were deliberately choosing this guy to be on the squad with the effort of then causing shame for the host nation.
Exactly, to make a point. So in the end, that tour was actually cancelled and the English cricket team didn't go to South Africa. Mm. So in Britain, there's a lot of questions around the relationship between sport and apartheid being asked even before this rugby tour. But it's not often, as we say, that cricket finds itself propelled into the middle of political scandals.
Indeed, true. But you mentioned, though, that the Springboks had already then arrived in Ireland, having toured Britain for a couple of months. And of course, it is there in Britain that they're met by real opposition and actually a surprising amount of disobedience.
Absolutely astonishing. I mean, Brian Hanley, the historian, has written about the visit of the Springboks to Britain in December 1969, right before they arrive in Ireland. And the numbers are amazing. 98 arrests in Aberdeen. you know, 69 in Manchester, 26 at Murrayfield, and very serious disturbances at Twickenham, where several policemen are injured. And when you look at who's involved in this, it's the up-and-coming generation of young political leaders in British society. Gordon Brown, you know, future Prime Minister of Britain, is on the committee in Edinburgh opposed to the visit. So this is something that's really kicking off over in Britain. And for the IRFU, looking across the Irish Sea, I imagine they were quite worried. You know, the Springboks were due to arrive in Ireland in weeks, and this raised very difficult questions.
Now, of course, this being Ireland of the late 1960s and the IRFU being a 32-county body, and with there being so much turmoil in Ulster, no doubt there was some sort of difficult clashing political questions around how you deal with something like this.
Absolutely. And there's people in the north who are very interested in the apartheid issue and who are making political capital off it. The Civil Rights Association, you know, is on the rise. And you've got these charismatic young leaders like Bernadette Devlin, who's a member of what's called People's Democracy. And, you know, she comes out and says it's no surprise that the corrupt and vicious unionist clique admire racist South Africans. So the idea of bringing the Springboks to the north is actually cancelled. The IRFU decide that won't happen. Instead, it's going to be focused very much on Dublin and Limerick. But there's protests outside the headquarters of the IRFU. And the real fear is, even if you've cancelled any visit to the north, will there be political demonstrations? Will people try and get onto the pitch? Can this game go ahead?
Now, the IRFU finds itself in a pretty tough position around all of this, because while it might not be quite the case in the 21st century where different political causes can be attached to different games and sporting bodies like to take on some of those causes, back in the 1960s and 70s, they tried not to make sports political. And of course, the IRFU, being a 32-county body, was explicitly trying not to make sport
and
political.
It's incredible that the IRFU managed to maintain itself as a 32-county body, you know, through the very worst of the troubles. I mean, partition split many things in Ireland, but sport sometimes got away, you know, not in the case of soccer, but in the case of rugby. And the IRFU said cultural and sporting relations are the last links that should be broken with a country whose laws and policies incurred condemnation. So they believed that there was potential power to unify rather than divide in sport. But one part of the story that's often overlooked is that the Springboks had actually come to Ireland only a few years before 1970, and there'd been basically no condemnation or no protest. So I think when you look at that, the 1970 visit is particularly controversial because, one, what had just happened in Britain, the response in Britain, and two, the emerging civil rights movement in Irish society. I mean, it was the timing as much as anything else. And that was the move. I mean, anti-apartheid activism just explodes in 1970. Michael D. Higgins, in his book, talks about this visit as defining. You know, he says, for people of my generation, the struggle against apartheid was the great defining moral argument of the second half of the 20th century, an issue which united people from Dublin to Durban. So this thing was just erupting, and the poor old IRFU found themselves in the crossfire.
Which then leads us to the reanimation of an older Irish concept, a concept that I think a lot of people don't realise these days is something that has its origins in Ireland, which is the boycott.
Yeah,
and there's multiple different boycotts considered on multiple different fronts for this.
An unfortunate man in Irish history, Captain Boycott, who gives us that global term, boycott. And I mean, the idea of boycotting the visit was beginning to gain momentum, you know, when people are looking at what was happening in Britain. So trade unionists in RTE, first of all, they said, look, can we stop showing this game? Can we make sure this game doesn't make it to the screen? Then the Irish Transport General Workers Union, largest union in the country, calls on its members not to cater the team. And it actually looks at one stage like, if the Springboks get here, one, they won't find the hotel.
Yeah.
And two, they won't find a transport company. No one's going to be willing to bring them around. And one newspaper condemns this as kind of industrial blackmail. But it was very, very clear before anything had taken place on the pitch that what was going to be reported on in Ireland was like, just like what had happened in Britain, events off the pitch. And as far as the IRFU were concerned, this thing was a fiasco from the beginning.
But nonetheless, though, and this is proven by the video of newsreel and everything else, and clearly the unionists in RTE didn't decide not to broadcast the game, because the game does go ahead and is televised.
And people went to it. Now, the numbers weren't great. I mean, there was something in the region of about 30,000 people at the game. So in one sense, the boycott had worked. But just like when, you know, Archbishop John Charles Bequay told people not to go and watch the Yugoslavs play soccer because they were a bunch of communists, people went anyway.
Yeah.
You know, some people were able to look beyond the kind of political controversies of the issue, and they wanted to go and see what should be a good game. But when the Springboks arrive in Dublin Airport, I mean, there's scuffles at the airport. They somehow make it to the hotel in Bray, and then the Post Office Officials Association cut the telephone wires. So they're stranded. I mean, they're surrounded by protesters. The telephone wires are cut. And this is above and beyond any kind of hostility that a visiting sports team had encountered before. Even the poor old Yugoslavs were able to walk around Dublin as tourists, basically, you know, in the days around their match. So it's a 9-9 draw in front of what is a relatively small audience.
Yeah.
But I think what really is defining about the archive footage of this game, it's a barbed wire fence, you know, designed to prevent protesters from getting on the pitch and disturbing the game, which is incredible. The idea of a game of rugby being played behind the barbed wire fence is astonishing.
I think that the footage, I think, is still included in reeling in the ears that you see every so often. And it's always so striking to think of what the Lansdowne Road Stadium, the Aviva Stadium, is nowadays, that once upon a time it had to be so fortified to try and ensure no kind of civil disorder, which is mad.
They could have done with a barbed wire fence in 1995 at the soccer.
Well, maybe that's a story for another day. We're coming up to the 25th anniversary of that soon. We might be talking about that in a couple of months' time. Speaking of a bit of civil disorder, though, in Limerick there was some unexpected and unwanted support
very
for the
strange,
South Africans.
Yeah, read it. Brian Hanley's a Limerick-born historian. His article on the visit to Limerick is extraordinary. A small band called the National Movement actually marched to the hotel where the team were staying and welcomed them. They got a letter of welcome from the National Movement, and they had placards saying things like, "We support white Christian South Africa," and "Box yes, Reds no," which is kind of odd, isn't it? But the Box had a great day off it on the field in Limerick, a lot better than in Dublin. They bet Munster 25-9.
Which is quite literally an embodiment of "Box yes, Reds no," considering the colours of the teams involved. All of this could be described in hindsight as being a watershed moment as far as Irish attitudes to apartheid are concerned, particularly because we're talking about the anniversary of the Dunn strike as well. But did the rugby aspect of things actually change anything?
In a sense, no. I mean, the game went ahead. Ultimately, the visit went ahead. And in 1981, Ireland actually toured South Africa. And that raised a lot of sharp criticism for the IRFU, because by that stage, I mean, the political opposition to South Africa had grown in all kind of camps. The IRFU only officially decided to seize South African fixtures in October 1989, very, very late in the day, and only a few short years before the ending of the kind of international boycott.
And actually, and that's kind of belated in some senses too, because as we all might remember with the Rugby World Cup just having concluded, the very first tournament was in 1987, and the Springboks at that point had already been decided by World Rugby they couldn't take
part.
So yet Ireland was still engaging in sports.
I think you've made a good point about the All-Ireland nature of the IRFU, that, you know, perhaps there was hope against hope as far as they were concerned, and they wanted to maintain some kind of political relationship or non-political relationship. But, you know, undoubtedly more significant was the Dunn strike of 1984. Ewan McCall put it, 10 young women and one young man, as the song went, you know, refusing to handle goods from South Africa. That would, you know, become a massive international news story. And eventually the Irish government banned the import of South African goods, which brought it to a conclusion. But Mary Manning, the young cashier who began that all, was invited to attend the funeral of Nelson Mandela. So as far as global impact was concerned, you know, it was the young workers of Dunn's, perhaps more than anything, that put Ireland on the world stage when it came to apartheid.
And the aforementioned Mandela, of course, then ultimately became a great champion of a rugby team that was once upon a time seen as a white supremacist organisation.
There's so much to celebrate in South Africa's victory on and off the pitch. And, you know, when South Africa won the 95 Rugby World Cup, 15-12 against the old enemy, the All Blacks, following that victory, you had this beautiful, very symbolic moment where Nelson Mandela, wearing a Springbok shirt, presents the trophy to the captain of the team, who was a white Afrikaner. So, you know, in the case of South Africa, rugby is the sport that embodies everything that's possible in terms of unity.
Yeah, and it certainly is nice to think that things like that can be achieved. I suspect we might be talking about the barbed wire that could have been used in Lansdowne Road in 1995, because that, if I remember, was February, which means the anniversary is only a couple of months away.
It is.
We'll be talking about that in a couple of months. But for now, Donald, as ever, thank you very much for that. Donald Fallon is a historian and he's the author of the Come Here to Me blog and books, volumes 1 and 2 of which are available in all good bookshops now.